call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Thursday, March 13th. We have just two items on the agenda today. We went over DHS's governor's supplemental budget. Today we're going to go over MDH's governor's supplemental budget, and then we have one bill up today, the 5% coalition's bill. With that, we'll just get started with MDH. Looks like Dave Greenman and the commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health, and thank you for this opportunity this morning. As you know, the Minnesota Department of Health is the lead public health agency in the state with the mission of protecting and improving the health of all Minnesotans. And we do that in three major ways. One, by assessing the health status, the health risks, and the opportunities for health among all Minnesotans. Secondly, by advancing policies and programs that create the conditions in which people can be healthy. And thirdly, by monitoring, evaluating, regulating, and when appropriate, delivering services that advance the mission of the health department. And as we learn more about what determines health and recognize that chronic diseases rather than acute and infectious diseases are currently our biggest challenge, we recognize the need to really change the narrative in our state about what creates health and build a health department that advances policy, systems, and environmental change that provides everyone the opportunity to be healthy. We know we have an excellent medical care system, but we also know that we can't treat ourselves into good health. To improve the health and reduce costs, we really need to rebalance our investments in treatment and prevention and advance the health and address the major health disparities that we have in our state. We believe that that's the only way that we will really be able to maximize the potential of all Minnesotans. The funding and support that you gave us last year in the budget has really been very helpful in advancing that mission of changing that conversation. The funding for SHIP and some of our core public health functions has helped us move closer to rebalancing that investment in treatment and prevention. And for that, we thank you and look forward to working with you on doing that. This year, as you know, is a non-budget year, so we have limited requests before you. Our focus has really been on items that need to be addressed this year to keep us moving forward. And while these proposals may not be as big and exciting as those that we would advance in a budget year, they are nonetheless important. And so we appreciate your consideration of these requests. Some of us may need to leave because we have also a budget hearing in the House at 10 o'clock, but we will have staff here listening to any testimony that there might be, and I would be pleased to meet with any of you to discuss any of the issues that come up. And with that, I will turn it over for the detailed presentation of our budget to Dave Greenman, our budget director. Dave.
Morning.
Welcome,
Dave.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. I'm here today to present the governor's proposals for his supplemental budget proposals for the 2014 session. We have a total of five proposals that I'll be walking through using the budget pages that are in your packet. With that, I'll start with the first proposal, which is an integrated licensing system for home care providers and home and community-based services providers.
One second. For members, we actually got them a little out of order, so
You'll
have to dive into a couple of...
You can certainly take them in the order you have them in as well.
I think we can roll.
Okay.
It's fine. You can...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the first proposal creates an integrated system for licensing home care providers who are licensed under the health department and for licensing home and community-based service providers who are currently licensed by the Department of Human Services. Even though these may sound like the same types of services, they actually provide different levels of care, different types of services, and are subject to different types of regulations. Currently, there are about 200 providers in the state who deliver both home care services and home and community-based services. Without a change in the law, these providers would have to get two separate licenses to deliver the care that they provide. During the 2013 legislative session, the legislature directed the Departments of Health and Human Services to work together to develop an integrated licensing system that would require these providers to get only one license to deliver their services. The agencies are required to deliver a report in February of 2014 with recommendations and proposed legislation for this integrated system, and this proposal represents those recommendations. Under the proposal, effective July 1, 2015, licensed home care providers licensed by the Department of Health will be eligible to obtain a home and community-based services designation that would allow them to deliver those services. They would be subject to some of the same standards as home and community-based services providers, and the designation that they receive would also be through the Department of Health. The result of this proposal is that providers would only have to work with one agency to one regulatory agency. They would have less administrative burden, and this would be a less expensive option for them than having to get two separate licenses. The proposal would require a designation fee up front to obtain the designation, and then a scaled fee at annual renewal. This proposal is funded through the state government special revenue fund. Over time, the fees generated through the system and the cost of providing the designation would balance as required by statute. Okay. The second proposal appropriates is our food, beverage, and lodging proposal. This proposal appropriates $670,000 in fiscal year 14 and $648,000 per year thereafter from the state government special revenue fund to cover the cost of regulating food, beverage, and lodging establishments in the city of St. Paul. The department assumed responsibility for these activities in July of 2013. There's no fee increase associated with this proposal. The fee revenue currently being collected from these establishments in St. Paul will offset the cost of the appropriation increase. The appropriation will support 7 additional FTEs at the department to inspect over 1,200 food, beverage, and lodging establishments in the city. These staff will ensure that safe food served in our restaurants, that they'll respond to food safety emergencies, ensure that public pools and lodging establishments provide safe sanitary conditions, and will respond to any sanitary condition complaints that occur within the city. One thing I would just add is that without this appropriation, the department cannot perform licensing activities for the city of St. Paul without compromising the regulatory activities that we provide in other parts of the state for food, beverage, and lodging establishments.
And in this one, it looked like, I mean, you did get authority to collect those fees. You've collected the fees, and what you're really doing is trying to have the appropriation to support the activities that you're collecting fees
Mr. Chair, and that
wasn't accomplished in last year's session.
Mr. Chair, yes, we have the authority to collect fees for doing this type of work.
Yep.
We took over the work in July of 2013 and used our authority to collect the fees. And so, we're just asking for an appropriation to get the fee revenue back so we can pay for the costs.
Senator Sharon?
You've answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Claussen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Historical perspective. I assume this was a function of the city of St. Paul at one time. I'm just wondering why the change to a state agency.
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, the department does have ultimate authority responsibility to regulate these types of establishments throughout the state. We do enter into delegation agreements with local jurisdictions. We have that authority. We have almost 40 of them throughout the state where the local jurisdictions do this work for us. We have been working with the city of St. Paul early last year in 2013. We determined that some of the obligations of the delegation agreement, several of the more serious ones, were not being met. We worked with the city for several months. We found that we weren't making adequate progress, wasn't being made, and we ultimately determined that we needed to reestablish our responsibility for doing that work.
Thank you.
In that vein, are there negotiations? Is the city of St. Paul interested in getting that authority back delegated to them at some point?
Mr. Chair, we certainly had many discussions with the city of St. Paul, and our obligation is really to protect the health and safety of people throughout the state, particularly in this case in St. Paul. And what our focus is really getting this program back on track so that we can make sure that food is provided in a safe manner. Once we get that established and get things back, we can possibly have other discussions at that point in time. As Mr. Greenman mentioned, we do have delegation agreements.
Yep.
Throughout the state, and our goal is always to work with local agencies as best as we can to make sure that We have a collaborative approach to safety in our food and beverage industry.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would just add that we've had some discussions with Ramsey County as well about them potentially taking it over. I don't think we're near any kind of an agreement with them, and I think they still have some decisions to make, but we have
at this point, for the foreseeable future, you're planning on carrying out these activities at the department. Senator Claussen?
Just a follow-up question. Curious about the funding arrangements. Are we shifting this from a city-based funding to a state allocation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, under the delegation agreements, the cities or the local jurisdictions would collect the fees and that use those to fund the activities.
These are all state government special revenue funds, a fee-supported activity that needs to balance out, and it's whether it's collected at the MDH side or the, Senator Sharon.
Go ahead. We're sort of getting stuck on this, but I'm just curious how the decision was it the cities that requested the department to take this on for a while, or what was the dynamic that occurred that made this shift when it could certainly remain in the responsibility of local government? I'm just curious about that. It's not relevant, I suppose, to our discussion
here. Commissioner?
I just heard the conversation about it. As soon as you get things sort of in order, you can reestablish the relationship that they carry out their functions. But so what dynamic occurred that this shifted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, as Mr. Greenman mentioned, we did an evaluation of our delegation agreement in the city of St. Paul and found that there were multiple problems with the oversight of the food and beverage and programs within the city. We worked on a quality improvement program for several months and really did not see the progress that needed to be made to assure the safety. And despite all of our efforts, we did not believe that they would be able to get to a point that they could actually protect the health and safety of residents of St. Paul. So then reassumed that responsibility at the state level.
Thank you.
All right. The next item.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is our spoken language health interpreters proposal. This proposal increases the appropriation from the state government special revenue fund to the department for maintaining our spoken language interpreter roster. The increased appropriation is $48,000 per year. The department's maintained the roster since 2009 as required under statute. Participation in the roster is voluntary. However, in 2011, legislation was passed that requires that any spoken language interpreter wishing to receive medical assistance coverage for their services is required to be enrolled in the roster. Not surprisingly, enrollment in the roster grew from just under 140 to over 3,200 in just a few short years. The initial appropriation for this program was $21,000 a year. And it's never been increased to keep up with the increased cost of the program. The current fee for the program is $50 per year for the interpreters. As a result, the program collects significantly more revenue than the appropriation that we receive, and the appropriation is also not adequate to cover the cost of the program. Some of the things we provide through the program is an electronic registration and fee payment system for the interpreters, a website where consumers can go and search for interpreters, and also we provide staff support for the interpreters as they sign up for the roster and need to make changes to the roster. One of the things that we expected was that the interpreters would need some assistance since many of them, English is their second language. However, the level of support they've needed has been higher than we expected, so we've had to spend more staff time than expected assisting them with this process. In addition, the roster currently doesn't provide any information about the qualifications of the interpreters, so the public really doesn't have a lot of information when they're going out and searching for interpreters to compare one to the other. One of the things we're going to do with this proposal is collect and display more information about the qualifications, the education, and the training of the interpreters so that the public can go out and understand and make informed choices when choosing an interpreter. Like as with the last proposal, the fee revenue we're collecting will cover the cost of the appropriation, so there's no fee increase associated with this.
Senator Sharon.
Is there any initiative or any effort moving forward to define basic competencies, their basic abilities in the persons who are on this roster?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, at this point, this proposal does not do that. What we wanted to do with this proposal essentially is, because it's a supplemental budget year, we only asked for an appropriation that would cover the cost of actually keeping the program moving forward currently designed to be. We're not changing anything in the roster. We're just making sure that it can continue to function and has an appropriation that meets its costs. We are aware that there are legislators out there who are looking at that that issue of looking at competencies and turning the roster into maybe something more like a registry, and we're more than happy to meet with those legislators and happy to work with them on something like that.
You know, you said it's $50 per year for the registry right now, 3,200 interpreters.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like this would actually be generating still a balance if you add the 48 and 21,000, still quite a bit left. Should we be looking at reducing fees at some point, or are you, because I mean, these are supposed to mm-hmm. balance out.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The law requires that the revenue that the fee programs bring in need to be equivalent over time to the cost of the program. Every 2 years, we do keep an eye on this program, and every 2 years, we do a departmental earnings report that we present to the legislature that takes a look at these programs, and we do make recommendations. Certainly, this proposal does leave a positive balance. So I think along with all of our other fee programs, we'll be looking at that in this coming year. Okay. The last proposal is our litigation expenses proposal. The governor recommends a one-time $975,000 appropriation in fiscal year 14 for the cost of settling a lawsuit related to the newborn screening program. The governor recommends paying for this settlement costs out of the Healthcare Access Fund by making a technical correction to the 2013 Health and Human Services Omnibus Finance Bill that returns $1 million per year from the Healthcare Access to the Healthcare Access Fund. The result is a net savings to the Healthcare Access Fund of $25,000 in fiscal year 14 and a $1 million per year savings thereafter. I thought it might be helpful to provide a little bit of background to explain how we got to where we are now with regard to the settlement and the lawsuit. As you recall, the newborn screening program tests about 68,000 infants per year for serious medical conditions, or over 50 types of serious medical conditions that, if not treated and detected early, could lead to long-term medical conditions and potentially even death. This program has been operating for a number of years. In 2006, an amendment was added to the Government Data Practices Bill during a House floor debate that made changes to the treatment of genetic information. The amendment was not heard in committee, and nor was there any discussion about how that language would impact the newborn screening program when it was passed. It was subsequently passed into law. As a result, this created some ambiguity in terms of it not being clear whether and how the law would apply to the newborn screening program. In order to try to remedy that situation, the department worked with legislators in 2007 and 2008 on legislation that would clear things up between how the two laws relate to each other. Legislation was passed in 2008, but it was vetoed, so the law didn't change at that time. In 2009, the department was sued by a group of families alleging that the newborn screening program violated this genetic information law. During the proceedings in the lawsuit, the department prevailed in the district court, at the district court level and at the appellate court level. However, the state Supreme Court did partially reverse that decision and sent the case back to district court, which essentially left the department with the choice of either settling the lawsuit or going to trial in early 2014. What we did is we took a careful look at, carefully weighed the legal and financial risks of settling the lawsuit against the potential cost of going to trial. Over the course of the 4+ years of the case, The department spent $550,000 on legal fees through the Attorney General's office and over $140,000 in fees for in-house attorneys. In addition to the legal costs, the public health lab staff spent literally thousands of hours responding to requests for information, providing information related to motions in support of at the request of both sides in the case. Ultimately, to avoid a considerable cost, the considerable cost of going to trial, the department did decide to that it would be in the state's best interest to settle the lawsuit. The settlement requires the department to pay a portion of the plaintiff's legal fees, but does not include any damages to the plaintiffs. And also in 2013, bipartisan legislation was passed that does clarify the law that created the ambiguity that led to the lawsuit.
You know, the one question I keep going over is how the heck did the Senate let a House floor amendment go into law without any hearings? Isn't that our job to clean those up? But aside from that, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I didn't hear in any of the testimony from the commissioner is how the Health Care Access Fund is responsible for these costs.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Benson, I think this was a decision that was made by MMB in the governor's office to use the Health Care Access Fund to pay for this. I think part of the rationale was that there was some savings to the Health Care Access Fund, a result of a technical correction. That may have been part of the reason.
So Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, then when we have future technical corrections, anybody can go into the Health Care Access Fund? I am very
Benson,
concerned.
I don't think so. In fact, I'm, you know, a little dubious as to whether this one will come out of the Health Care Access Fund.
And I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I think the department needs to go back and find another source of revenue. SHIP grants would be more appropriate.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. If we're looking for money, don't go to the Health Care Access Fund. It is in enough financial trouble as it is.
Now, you do have one other in our packet, the technical correction.
Yes, I'm sorry. We have one other technical correction. This is purely technical. It's been discussed with the fiscal analysts in both the House and the Senate. And essentially, there's a couple of changes that needed to be made to the rider section. In one case, some funding was shown as being appropriated in the bill that actually the department has the authority in statute to spend, and it wasn't actually appropriated in the bill. It's special revenue fund dollars. We just took that reference out of the bill. And also, there was a legislation last year that was passed related to the infectious disease lab that would stop the way of financing the lab through fees and appropriations out of the state government special revenue fund and start them using contracts with private contracts instead of using the fee program. Inadvertently, the appropriation ended 1 year early, and we need to just go back. I think there was a technical problem. The fee is still being collected until the end of this fiscal year. We just need to get the appropriation so that we can get the money that is being generated through the fee to cover the costs until July 1 of 14.
All right. Any questions of members on that proposal? Any questions of members for MDH on the package of proposals or other items? We do have space for public testimony. We haven't had anybody sign up yet, but is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak on the MDH supplemental budget proposed by the governor? Seeing none, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank
Mr. Greenman.
Thank you.
And we will pick up Senate File 1993. Senator Eakin. Thank you. Senator Eakin, I understand you have an author's amendment to delete everything.
Yes.
Passing that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, it's not
it's
a delete
not
everything.
Delete everything. It's
okay. But it's a author's amendment in A1.
Yes, the Senator. A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, and should be passed around. This is really an oversight. There were services that were not listed that were intended to be. The fiscal note does fit with this amendment. This does not add anything to it. So it's just simply getting it in the shape and form that I would like. So,
Senator Eakin moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Eakin, on the bill, you can describe it with the, and the fiscal note is being handed out, I believe, as well. You can describe the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. This bill has been known as the 5% campaign bill. It provides a 5% rate increase for home and community-based services for older adults and people with disabilities. I'm very grateful that this bill has clone bills and actually has 42 authors. I don't know if that's a record or not, but I think it must be close if it's not. And so it's demonstrated great support in the caregivers and the advocates and the people who are receiving these services and their families are very grateful as well to have seen so much support in the legislature. And there are 123 community organizations that do support the bill. Those organizations are listed in your handout. I do have with me today Steve Larson, who is the Senior Policy Director for ARC Minnesota and co-chair of the 5% campaign, and also Paula Hart, who is the President and CEO of Volunteers of America. There will also be other testifiers who will talk about the importance of the 5% increase in their lives. And just a little bit about what the bill does. As I already stated, it provides a 5% rate increase effective July 1st of 2014 for 17 home and community-based services. These include the disability and elderly waivers, ICFs, DD, assisted living, day training and habilitation for people with developmental disabilities, PCAs, in-home care, and home-delivered meals. Providers receiving the increase are required to spend 75% of the new funding on staff compensation, and the providers must develop a plan on how they will distribute the funds, post that plan for all employees, and have it available for the commissioner. I think it's important to note as well that the remaining 25% can also be used for caregiver compensation and training. It's just that it's not required to be used for those purposes, so it just allows for greater flexibility of the remaining 25%, and that's because obviously there are other needs as well, needs in maintaining stable and safe operations to pay for the ever-increasing fixed costs like fuel and insurance. A little bit about why the bill is needed. First and foremost, it's needed because we need to provide quality care for these people with disabilities and for the seniors in their homes that will be affected by this. And quality care for older adults and people with disabilities should be a top priority in the state of Minnesota. Quality care that is provided by a consistent, well-compensated core of caregivers. This will go a long way to reducing staff overturn, which is becoming a bigger and bigger problem in this field because of the low wages. And that's critical to the quality of care. People with disabilities in particular need that stability in their lives. And that stability has been jeopardized because of the lower and lower pay that these individuals have been receiving who provide that care. Just speaking from personal experience, it's been especially pronounced in the area that I represent in Moorhead, where right across the border, they can make more than $2 an hour or more. We've seen heavy turnover rates as a result. There's been a number of folks I've talked to who have been training these individuals who say once they've trained them, then they simply leave and go across the border. And we've spent all that money, all that time, all that effort training these individuals, and then to lose them to another state, it's really a shame. And it does cost a lot for training these individuals. It's estimated that we lose $2,000 every time we lose somebody like that and then have to retrain somebody else. So there's a real cost to not paying these individuals what they deserve. The quality of life is so important to enable people with disabilities and older adults to make choices that will allow them to live more independently and be a part of their communities. A rate increase for the home and community-based services is a major piece of the business that was left over from the 2013 session. We did provide an increase for the nursing homes, and we did provide an increase for these services as well, but it was only a 1% increase. And so what we're trying to do here is to provide parity. And it's important that we provide parity with the long-term care providers in the institutional settings in our nursing homes, because they really are providing the same kind of services, and they really are part of the same workforce pool. So there's a competition between the two, and they should be moving together. The 1% increase, by the way, does not start until April of this year. And again, we believe that the 5% is necessary to bring us up to parity. Providers and their caregivers have received a net of increase of only 3.4% since 2003. So over a 10-year period, only a 3.4% increase. In that same time period, inflation went up 24.5%. And it gives you some idea of how far behind they have fallen. Caregiver wages and benefits and providers' ability to stay on top of their costs have lagged way behind the cost of living, causing high caregiver turnover, which I've already spoken about, and extreme pressure on providers to maintain stable businesses. I oftentimes have said that many of the people working in this profession, I've seen many who've stayed in this profession despite the falling pay, because they're so committed to providing the care for these individuals. And I've said that they do it, I think, for psychic income, because they know what they're doing is so important, so vital, not just to the lives of these individuals, but to their families and to the communities in which they live. But psychic income only goes so far. You can't raise your children on psychic income. You can't feed your family on psychic income. You need to have a fair compensation in order to provide for your families. And the most tragic thing that I have seen as a result of the lack of keeping up is to see people who have been so committed and who want to do this and who do such a great job providing this care leave the profession because they can't afford to do it anymore. So this bill, I think, will go a long way to reestablishing our leadership in providing quality services for our most vulnerable citizens. It doesn't get us back to where we used to be, but it's a partial catch-up. It's moving in the right direction, and I think we need to start moving down that path today. The bill acknowledges the extraordinary work of caregivers, their daily work ranges from complex services with medically fragile people to the most intimate of cares, like toileting, to services needed for daily living, like job coaching, transportation, and meals. And I really feel that we in Minnesota, you know, we're a state that doesn't leave anyone behind. And I feel that that's what this state does, is to ensure nobody gets left behind. And with that, as I said, I have with me today Steve Larson, who will also testify as to why this bill is so important.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson, Senior Policy Director with the ARC Minnesota.
Welcome
and
to the committee, Mr. Larson.
And I'm also a co-chair of the 5% campaign. There is a handout, and I just want to let you know that there are some corrections that need to be made to that handout. And I also want to let you know that my administrative support person, Bruce Nelson, accepts responsibility for the errors and copies, and I will take appropriate disciplinary action. But instead of the handout designed for the Senate, we have the list of representatives. And the organizational supporters list is not the most updated one either. So we will get that corrected information to you, and I assure you I will take whatever corrective action I need with my staff support person. So I do want to acknowledge the great support that we have received from this committee with co-authors, and I also want to thank the chair for your guidance and consultation and preparation of this bill over the past several months, and we greatly appreciate that. So why did I, as public or senior policy director for an advocacy organization sign on to be co-chair, because this impacts over 90,000 Minnesotans with disabilities and older adults also with disabilities and their lives. With Senator Eakin has highlighted, we've had minimal increases over the past 10 years, and we've now created a crisis as far as our direct support staff, and this is an initial step to try to turn that around. People receiving services, if we pass this bill, will have enhanced choices to create lives they choose and be more independent in our communities. Caregivers are direct support professionals, now often work two or three jobs to support themselves and their families. Because of low wages, many are forced to leave their jobs for other work. We cannot afford to lose these highly skilled workers. Families and people receiving services say over and over again that high staff turnover is the single biggest threat to quality care. Having consistent staff who know the individual's needs of the people they support is one of our core services for quality care. A 5% increase in 2014 will help caregivers support their families and continue as caregivers for our most vulnerable people. This bill will help reduce staff turnover. All communities will be enriched and will be keeping within the Olmstead decision as people with all abilities allow, or this will help people with all abilities to be more and fully involved in their communities. As co-chair of this campaign, it has been in some ways one of the easiest and hardest campaigns to be co-chair of. Easiest because we have not had to work to activate people around the state to contact all 201 of their legislators. People have come to us and asked how they can participate in this campaign, and it's been easy because of that. It's been hard because this is such a vital need that we've been putting off and holding off giving raises to our direct support staff, and it's hard to hear some of the stories about the work that they do and the sacrifices that they make. But having said that, it looks like with the governor's budget proposal, we've set a floor of 4%. But this is the 5% campaign, and we urge your full support of the 5% campaign. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Paula Hart. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Members, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. My name is Paula Hart, and I'm president and CEO of Volunteers of America in Minnesota. We have been here in Minnesota for 118 years this spring. I'm here today to urge you also to support this legislation to directly improve the lives of people with disabilities and seniors, including hundreds of people served by Volunteers of America each year who depend upon home and community-based funding in our seniors and special needs programs. Specific to seniors, we have participants in a number of our services who directly benefit from the elderly waiver every day. Between our Park Elder Center, which serves Hmong elders in a culturally relevant way, and the Southwest Senior Center in Minneapolis, which I know a number of you have been to, we supply structured programs to more than 75 seniors, and I'm sorry that this age starts at 50, which I'm not quite sure about, but older adults age 50 to 96, providing dignity, hope, and an independent quality of life. Let me tell you about one of them. Jack is an 82-year-old participant at our Southwest Senior Center who operated a truck on the Iron Range before he moved to Minneapolis. A stroke cost Jack his job, his housing, and really his way of life. The social worker at Southwest Senior Center, Linda Walker, who is part miracle worker, really helped him find housing and also sign up for the adult day program funded by the elderly waiver. Thanks to these services, Jack today receives regular health monitoring, socialization, nutrition, care planning, exercise, one-to-one counseling, and is really a full member of his community. The elderly waiver saves Minnesota $275 million a year by enabling seniors like Jack and caregivers like Linda who support him to access this type of home and community-based support while living in the most independent setting possible. Beyond our adult day services at Volunteers of America, we also provide assisted living services funded by the elderly waiver. We help more than 100 seniors and people with disabilities each month with an average age of 85 who live in subsidized housing in Minneapolis and surrounding areas. 98% of that funding comes from the elderly waiver and the community alternatives for disabled individuals or CADI waiver. Our assisted living programs minimize nursing home placement and reduce clinic visits by providing home health services, homemaking services, and meals to the people we serve. They also receive medication administration and management, delegated nursing services, supervision, and daily wellness checks. The elderly waiver is the only source of funding available to these people for home health services. At Volunteers of America, we're also part of the Long-Term Care Imperative, which is a collaboration of providers that works to promote personal choice and dignity in older adult services. I speak for this group also when I urge you to help us preserve Minnesota's superlative long-term care services, really some of the best, if not the best, in the country by supporting this measure. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hart. Next, it looks like we have Bobby Guidry. I hope I didn't mispronounce that too badly. Welcome
actually,
to the committee.
You got it just right. Not always easy. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Bobby Guidry. I'm the Director of Housing and Community-Based Services for the Benedictine Health System. I've worked in elder care for 35 years, which always blows me away a little bit, in nursing homes and assisted living as a social worker administrator and now as a corporate director. I'm also a primary caregiver for my mom, who's walking the dementia long journey of decline. It has truly been an honor and a privilege to serve elders of the state of Minnesota. The Benedictine Health System provides assisted living services as waiver providers in 21 communities around the state, many of them rural. Our average age in those settings is 88. Usually people are with us for about 2 years on average. As differentiated from skilled care, stays are averaging about 28 days. Currently, we have are receiving serving 300 elders who receive some support from elderly waiver right now. And as I was listening to the introductory comments, we also have community-based services where folks are funded under waiver as well, adult day, home-delivered meals in many of our communities, and I did not include those numbers here. To be eligible for waiver funding, individuals must meet the nursing home level of care criteria, meaning they would be most likely served in a nursing home if they weren't in the more cost-effective community setting of assisted living. We do see a wide range of needs for those on waivers, memory care being a huge need, medication management, assistance with mobility and toileting, and other services that can't be scheduled, so you can't fill those needs by just someone coming to the home a couple times a day. You have to be able to respond to an unscheduled need. Those are often also mental health, folks with mental health needs, seniors with mental health complicated by other challenges and often compounded by depression from isolation when folks have been at home alone or fear for their own safety in living alone. In the past few years, waiver in assisted living received double-digit legislative and administrative cuts, and we do realize and appreciate the 1% increase that goes into effect in April. But please do realize that that's on top of about 15% reductions in waiver from a couple of different avenues over the past few years. As a long-term care provider that accepts elderly waiver, we do rely on the decisions you make for what we get paid and for what we can pay our staff. In the last facility that I was the director of, our staff went 5 years with wages frozen, which was really tough, and a lot of those folks are still there, and you know, I too so appreciate their dedication, but it's tough, and many were working the two jobs at least. It's up to all of you to pass that 5% adjustment to waivers to ensure our seniors have continued access to programs and services. I have already seen some providers who served heavily a waiver, folks dependent on waivers, close their doors. I've seen others stop taking folks in that need waivers or at least just to serve the people who are already there who may need that service going forward. And that's certainly not what we want to do. We want to be here. We are here to serve, and we want to continue to do that for everyone. Just a few points to end with. There's a large and growing population of individuals who can't live independently but want to remain in their community. And for these folks, the Minnesota's Elderly Waiver Program provides a cost-effective and efficient manner to live. And again, the waiver recipients do have to qualify for nursing home level of care, so they do have significant needs. We have challenges retaining and attracting quality experienced caregivers because of competition with other providers and businesses, as mentioned in the introduction as well. Even, you know, in rural areas, competing with Walmart or the fast food settings. And another thing that we experience a lot is if there's a large hospital system nearby, similar to the Minnesota-North Dakota comparison, you know, down in the Mayo area, for example, you know, we are often the training ground and then folks go on to the hospital. So the an increase of 5% in the waiver funding would go at least some way in refunding the reductions we've had, and it would be greatly appreciated. Home and community-based services is responding to the call to access the right care at the right time in the right place for the best price for both the state and the individual. There are more of us coming into our senior years, providing cost-effective supports to keep us safe and cared for in our home communities and in the place that we call home is what Minnesota is all about. The long-term care imperative, of which we are a part as well, is fully supportive of the 5% campaign and the goal of increasing the payment rates for individuals on elderly and CADI waiver. We would appreciate the support of each of you to make this happen this session. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Guidry. Next, we have John Bringwatt from Lutheran Social Services. Is that correct? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name again for the record.
John Bringwatt. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Bringwatt. As director of Lutheran Social Services Senior Companion Program, I can speak to the dramatic impact that companionship services funded under the elderly waiver have for helping frail, isolated elders to remain in their own homes and apartments. At this moment, 450 very low-income nursing home-eligible clients around the state are receiving weekly or every other week visits through LSS. These visits typically also include taking clients to medical and dental appointments for grocery shopping and other events in the community. Research confirms that isolation, loneliness, and depression correlate with negative health outcomes, increased medical expenses, and often premature placement in a nursing home. When asked how not having a companion would affect them, these comments included, "Drastically, my volunteer helps me pick my medications up, which I would not be able to get if I didn't have this person available to buy food and other necessities. I can't read English or write. My volunteer helps me to communicate. More lonely, no one to consult with besides my caregiver. I'd have no way to get out, to walk and shop helps depression. Being busy, talking, going out to lunch sometimes, playing cards helps my mental health. I would be a hermit. It would be terrible. It's really important. I would not have been able to live independently without my companion. I would have no transportation, and I would be lonely. I'm getting weaker and losing sight. I need the assistance. So I urge you to support the 5% initiative. In addition to a waiver dollars increase, it would also increase our state grant funding, allowing us to serve more low-income clients who do not qualify for the waiver, keeping them in the community longer. Mm-hmm. Allow me to close with a note written by Juliet, a woman receiving companionship services through LSS. Often people don't stop to think about older persons with or without disabilities unless and until they are in the same boat. I certainly didn't. I'm totally blind, live by myself, and despite the fact that I take advantage of the paratransit system, the Senior Companion Program is enabling me to continue staying in my own home, feel less isolated, and connect to the community at large. How do they do it? Volunteers are paired with us based on our and their interests, temperaments, time availability, and neighborhood proximity. With the right match, this can change someone's life. For myself, far more than helping me shop, taking me to medical appointments, or sharing a good meal, I look forward to seeing my friend, the volunteer, to talk about our shared values, politics, funny, and or heartbreaking stories either read about or in our own lives. And just to know that I can count on this wonderful person sharing her life with me once a week. There is never a lack of things to talk about. I am so blessed to have this person in my life, and thanks to the Senior Companion Program, this is possible for me. I'm sure there are many testimonials like mine. I hope these will inspire and encourage you to volunteer and share your precious time and life with us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bringawatt. Next, it looks like we have Sheena Bauer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Sheena Bauer, and I am a direct support professional. I have worked for a service provider named Fraser for 2 years. Fraser is a nonprofit agency that was founded by families nearly 8 decades ago. I came into disability services after a few years of professional jobs in some unrelated fields, and I knew after my first day at Fraser that I had found my career, the career that I was meant to do. Quite simply, I had never felt so rewarded or motivated by any other job. I've had the privilege over the past year of being the primary staff member for a gentleman named Amr. Amr's in his mid-30s, and he is one of the kindest, gentlest souls I've ever met. He's one of the most empathetic people I've known. A big part of my job has been to help Amr in managing his health and wellness. Amr has Down syndrome, along with a number of additional health conditions, including bipolar disorder, diabetes, and also a tracheotomy, which require active medical management. I've never met anyone who goes to the doctor as often as Amr does. He usually has at least 3 scheduled clinical appointments a month, minimum, sometimes many more. I've gone with him to each and every doctor's appointment during my time as his support staff. It's been important for him to have someone from his community-based team that can participate in these clinic visits, because our team helps implement the plan that these doctors create for him. His doctor has gotten to know us, and I've linked with the care coordinator at his clinic when there are changes or follow-up between clinic appointments. Amr also has obstructive sleep apnea. It's a common condition for people who have Down syndrome. Amr's was so severe that he ended up having to undergo a tracheotomy a few years ago. He now has daily and weekly care duties that need to be done in order to keep the tracheotomy equipment clean and healthy. He's learned to do much of it himself, and some of it requires help from staff. One of Amr's goals is to pursue more community involvement. A side effect of the tracheotomy is that he has loud breathing and coughing. For a long while, he was reluctant to leave the house due to self-conscious feelings. Our team has learned over the past year the best way to invite and encourage him to be more active in the community. Amr is very fortunate to have a very active and involved family, but stepping back, I realize that many individuals aren't as fortunate and don't have families that live close by. Their families might not be as actively involved. The people we support in our programs don't necessarily think of us as paid help. They think of us as their families. They value the hugs we share as much as the care that we provide. They cry when any of our long-term staff members quit. For all of these reasons, the professional requirements of the job, the impact of the individuals who rely on these supports, I ask you to please support Senate File 1993. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Bauer, thank you for your work and coming forward and sharing your stories. Senator Eakin, did you have any additional testimony?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Kurt Rutzen.
I saw Kurt in the audience. I was wondering why he wasn't going to come talk to us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. Before I begin, I'd like to say to Jeff Hayden, we'd have to compare watches.
Oh. we'll take a look at it.
I get it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So, thank you. Thank you for having me. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Kurt Rutzen. I'm with the ARC of Minnesota. I'm on the National ARC Board in Washington, D.C., and I'm the past chair of Region 10 in Southeast Minnesota. I want to talk today. I fully support the 5% campaign increase. I had a woman, her name is Bob, who helped me, and that's the really only support I get. But Bob was an incredible lady, and she'd help me with some of the forms I had to fill out. Some of the forms aren't easy, and I can't even do them. And they're complicated. And Bob left for another job, and I was heartbroken because Bob was an amazing lady who knew everything and knew the stuff. And she, I'm sure she left for a little higher paying job. And without this 5% increase, as you probably heard, and I've talked to many of you, I think, about, I was talking to somebody the other day in the hall about, like it or not, these people who need, not want really, because they don't really even want, they need this care. These individuals do some pretty intimate things, like bathing and some other things. And if you're switching staff every couple weeks, I tell you, Chair and committee members, I would be so afraid. Okay, John, tonight is giving a bath. Now meet Bob. You have no idea. We got to establish some rapport and some ongoing long term, and they want to stay, but it's just comes down to, as everything else does, unfortunately, the pay. And I thank you guys for listening, and my heart goes out to all of you. Thank you.
Kurt, thank you for coming forward and sharing your story. It makes a big difference to all of us. Senator Eakin, any further testimony?
No further testimony that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did see that Kurt is has a watch that's bigger than mine, and I never thought that would actually happen. So thankful for his testimony, everybody for their testimony. I think it really shows how important this issue is. Mr. Chair, I have talked to the author, and I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. And with that, I think if Mr. Albrecht and Mr. Lebago have some, can kind of walk us through, and we also may have some testimony from the long-term impaired and folks to walk us through this.
Mr. Lebago?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I guess I'll wait for the amendment to go around. This is providing a, just generally speaking, this is providing a nursing facility rate adjustment. And I'll actually turn your attention to page 2, section 3 of the nursing facility rate adjustment. So section 3, subdivision 1 stipulates the rate adjustment application process. And these are compensation reports provided from nursing facilities to DHS on compensated hours for employees making less than $14 an hour. There's also some stipulation regarding collective bargaining agreements, which is standard language when we've been providing rate increases for nursing facilities. Subdivision 2 actually calculates the rate adjustment. It bases it off of a range of compensation hours, dollars per hour, subdivision 3 on page 3 provides for the actual adjustment itself beginning on October 1st, 2014, and it's required that the rate adjustment must go towards salary and compensation-related costs for employees making less than $14 an hour. And then going back to the first section of the amendment, this is just adjusting the external fixed cost portion of nursing facility rate increases to account for this increase, and you can see that language actually on the top of page 2. And in addition, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, on page 2, line 9, there'll need to be a change. The year 2015 will need to be changed to 2014.
Senator Hayden will incorporate that in as an oral amendment to his amendment. Is that correct, Senator Hayden?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Anything further on amendment? Senator Eakin?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
And Senator Hayden, I appreciate the amendment, and I do support the amendment and feel that it is important to recognize the effect that a minimum wage increase would have on our long-term care facilities. I do feel that we as a state, if we really believe in raising wages for lower-income workers, that we should put our money where our mouth is and practice what we preach, I guess, and to actually provide that assistance that's necessary to get people up to these wages. And so that would be my my position on the amendment. Thank you.
So are your folks here to testify, or can we just answer questions from members, or is that – what's your preference on that, Senator Eakin?
Okay. Yeah, they'd like to testify. So,
welcome to the committee.
Okay, Mr.
State
Chair,
your name for the record.
Senator Eakin, members of the committee. My name is Todd Bergstrom, and I work with Care Providers in Minnesota. This is my colleague Jeff Bostick, who works with Aging Services in Minnesota, and together we work together as the Long-Term Care Imperative. We do have an issue paper which we can hand around, and what we really want to do is just go over the very general, and then. Which what I will do regarding the proposal, and Jeff will handle some of the more specifics of the proposal. So how it was developed, specifically the proposal is to provide facility rate increases based on the direct and indirect effect of raising the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour. According to the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, about 7.9% of nursing facility employees earn less than $9.50 an hour. And as you'll see in the issue paper that's been handed around, on page 1 there's a map. And what this really informs this map is that it would be a lot easier if we could just have a simple proposal that said we're going to have an across-the-board increase of X percent to solve this issue. However, what you see by the map is actually it varies quite a bit throughout the state in terms of who makes less than $9.50 per hour. And so what you actually end up with is we developed a very general model that ultimately becomes a very specific process for each nursing facility to receive specific rate increases regarding kind of what their effects are regarding raising the minimum wage. Why this is important, on page 2 you'll note virtually all of the revenue that nursing facilities have or earn comes from either the state government is regulated by rate equalization or through the federal Medicare program. And so that's why we simply can't go out and raise our prices to comply with raising the minimum wage. On the third page, what you see is just our labor market is difficult, like everyone's, I suppose, but it has returned to kind of pre-recession levels. And so this proposal is basically trying to keep us at our current status within the labor market. And so what we ended up doing was we used deed data. We use nursing facility statistical cost report data to come up with a methodology to not only estimate the direct effect, but also come up with what that indirect or ripple effect would be for nursing facilities. And our estimates are it's about $4.6 million. But the specifics, which I'll turn over to Jeff, really becomes how do you actually have a proposal that allows each nursing facility to address their specific issues.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, there's some tables on page four
Please,
and five.
State your name for the record.
Jeff Bostick with Aging Services in Minnesota. Without getting deep into the tables, and I'm happy certainly to discuss details with anyone who wants to know more about how it was developed, but essentially what we're trying to do is a facility-specific adjustment based on their current wages to get them an adequate amount of money to move their what they're paying in wages forward to reflect $9.50, if that's what the new minimum wage is going to be, and to help them deal with people who are close to the current level of $9.50, get them a little bit more so that they're positioned as being a little bit above the minimum wage. It's based on actually what people are able to pay today, and it'll give them enough money to pay a little bit more. So the facilities that would be most affected by just going to $9.50 without funding will be essentially made whole by our proposal is the intent.
Thank you, Mr. Bostick. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Hayden, for bringing this amendment forward and Senator Egan for accepting the amendment. I think this is clearly the missing piece to this entire long-term care issue that we're facing. And it was amazing in the fall that we were talking about minimum wage, but there was very few people that truly understand the effect it was going to have on our long-term care facilities if we did not do some kind of rate adjustment for these facilities. And so now I think the information is getting out appropriately. This amendment deals with that fact, and I think the whole campaign and Senator Eakin, you did a very nice job in explaining the issues that we have before us in this dealing with our specialized clients here. And so I wholeheartedly support this amendment. Thank you.
Any other comments of members, questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question because the minimum wage is still an outstanding issue. It's not set yet. And so does this permanently raise the base? I'm trying to get through the amendment. Does this permanently raise the base for nursing homes regardless of what happens in negotiations for the minimum wage?
Well, Senator Benson, this would be laid on the table for possible inclusion. I think we will have more information about what may or may not happen with the minimum wage before we construct our omnibus bill or before we pass it in its final form, and we would have the opportunity to adjust the formulas if something other than what we're working on today were to pass into law as far as the minimum wage. So okay. I think that this is kind of the best estimate of what the formula might look like and gives members an idea of how it would play out under the current structure. But if things change, it'll be on the table, and we'll construct it in a way that is consistent with what ultimately becomes law.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. As it's drafted, it appears that we're setting a new base for nursing homes, so we would have a nursing home minimum wage, which is a policy discussion we might want to have. I just want to be clear if we're attempting to tie to something that is also moving legislatively or if we're making the policy decision that if you work in a nursing facility, this will be your minimum wage.
Well, and I'll get staff to confirm this, but the way this is drafted as well is it operates one time and becomes part of the base, but it goes in, it doesn't, it's uncodified language, so it'll be built in to a one-time rate adjustment that becomes part of that nursing home's base, but it's not going to stay on the books forever as a constant adjustment factor. They'll get that increase built into their rate so that they'll be able to support those wages into the future, but it's not going to be a new part of the calculation every time we come to a new year to set rates. Does that make sense and help? Mr. LeBaco, did I say it about right? Close enough?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. I just want to point out, again, on the top of page two, tying into page one, so the external fixed costs, these are calculation of payment rates for things like surcharges and the licensing fees that they incur. That's tied into their rate. And if and when this passes, and there's actually a chapter law, the top of page two would reflect that part of the external fixed costs would be for the rate adjustment in this section three. So, yes.
Any other questions, comments? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves the A2 amendment as orally amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any other amendments? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves Senate File 1993 as amended be laid over for. What do we do? I'm not even. We don't have an omnibus bill. I didn't get clear on my motion. The omnibus finance bill. Let me just explain what's going to happen here. We're going to construct an article in this division to send over to. In the Senate, we do one omnibus finance bill at the end of the day that'll be carried by Senator Cohen. It's different than what we do in the first year of a biennium. So we're laying it over for possible inclusion in the article that will be forwarded to Senator Cohen. I should have gotten straight on exactly how to say that before I appeared with it. But for inclusion into the omnibus finance bill, be the motion. Any comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.